cold, dark skin light.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. Never wanna put us in the media, bro.
Wanna fat beauty like Kardashians. Wanna fat beauty. We welcome you to another edition of Spitfire. Spitfire is a monthly radio broadcast for women of color, by women of color, that airs every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. First off, Spitfire acknowledges that we are settlers on the traditional territory of the Ganegahaga people. The Ganegahaga are the keepers of the Eastern Door of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. We believe that it's not enough just to acknowledge the keepers of this land, and that everyone, ourselves included, should seek greater awareness to actively confront colonialism and neocolonialism in its many forms, and work to deconstruct and decolonialize. Starting points for self-education are reclaimturtleisland.ca and idlenomore.ca, and we encourage you to go check those out. For tonight's show, we have a guest with us, which is really exciting.
Yes!
Serene is a member of the Pan Asian Collective, which is a network of support and friendship among diverse members of the Asian community. It aims to increase meaningful engagement in Asian history and culture in a way that recognizes the diversity of Asian experiences. So she's here to talk about us, to talk with us about the collective and some of the important issues for the Asian community. And we'll be hearing from her later on in the show. Afterwards, we're going to do a little recap of the year and talk about our reflections, where we're at, and how we're entering 2021. It's a big one. So stay tuned for this and much more on Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to Peng Black Girls by ENNYNE, featuring Emia Brave, and The Praise by the mesmerizing South African duo Ukoi Koi. As usual, we will dive into some highlights and headlines that caught our attention during the last month.
Okay, so probably many of you have heard about farmer protests in India. So over the past couple of weeks, there have been mass protests in India by farmers who have been protesting the laws for nearly 2 months in the Punjab and Haryana states. So the situation escalated last week when tens of thousands marched to New Delhi, where they clashed with police. So according to the CBC, the farmers, who are majority are Sikh, have been protesting legislation in India that deregulates agricultural markets and opens them up to private corporations. And this is something that we see all over the, you know, air quotes, developing world. I know that certainly in the Philippines, this is a huge issue. And last year, there were a whole bunch of laws that were passed in the Philippines that did exactly that. And so the farmers and people in general fear that these reforms will lead to the eventual elimination of government price protections, which in turn will push them off their ancestral farmlands, aka land grabbing. These are believed to have been some of the largest protests ever in the world have been held. And what's been cool is that we've been seeing in Canada a lot of solidarity protests, particularly by the Sikh communities in the West Coast. So definitely keep an eye on that. Another piece of news, which most likely our listeners have heard about, are the Uyghur human rights violations that have been going on. The Uyghurs are a Muslim ethnic minority in China that mostly live in the northwestern region of the country. There's been an ongoing troubling situation where roughly over a million Uyghurs have been interned in labor and detention camps since 2017. And the Chinese government continues to deny that any significant human rights violations are occurring. And they talk about these camps as re-education camps or camps that are designed to actually help Uyghurs integrate into the labor market and find jobs. However, we know from sources such as Human Rights Watch and others that this is not the case. A troubling development has been that recent reports have demonstrated or illustrated how certain companies like Adidas, Victoria's Secrets, Bombardier, Lacoste, and Nike have either directly or indirectly benefited from Uyghur forced labor. So another thing to think about as you do your holiday shopping.
I just wanted to jump in. It's Serene. I just wanted to say to the Uyghurs in like Xinjiang, there's also non-Muslim Uyghurs. Like they're all different kinds of Uyghurs. I just wanted to point that out because I feel like a lot of times in mainstream media, like Uyghurs as Muslims is used a lot in like common narratives about this. And there's a lot of Islamophobia towards these communities. And a lot of times it's kind of posed as like they're being, you know, put into these concentration camps because they are Muslim. Although that sometimes is true, like non-Muslim Uyghurs are also being put into concentration camps as well. And it's more just the CCP trying to suppress minority groups in China in general.
Thank you for sharing that. So this headline is coming out of Abbotsford, BC, and it speaks volumes to Canada's treatment and inconsideration for Indigenous people. So Krista McGuinness, who is also an Indigenous woman, called out her 11-year-old school, Abbotsford WA Middle School, regarding the assignment the children were given. They were basically told to research 5 positive aspects of Canada's residential schools. In what world there are positive aspects of that, and whoever the teacher was who decided that was going to be a good idea, I feel like they should be suspended, or I don't know, something needs to happen, because that is absolutely inappropriate and disgusting. McGuinness took to TikTok to share the following message. I was disgusted, and then I was outraged, and then honestly, I was broken for my people. This was downplayed in such a horrible way that just completely discredited all the trauma that First Nations people have gone through in the aftermath of residential schools. And to add insult to injury, McGuinness also points out that this assignment is particularly insulting to the neighboring community of Mission, BC, where St. Mary's Residential School operated until 1984. Currently, the Abbotsford School District said it has launched an investigation, but we all know what that means. More likely, nothing's going to come out of this. Whether or not they've learned from this experience, we'll be telling in the future. But I feel like in 2020, this should not have even been a subject where they broach this towards like students, or give students an option to look for positive in that, because this should have been a teachable moment where they could have researched the impacts of residential schools and what that means for generational trauma. And there was so much to unpack with that, and I feel like that teacher dropped the ball 1000%.
Agreed.
There's also Janjali Rao, who has been named Time's First Kid of the Year. Personally, I would have just said Person of the Year. But she is a scientist and an inventor who has created new technologies, including a device that can help with water contamination by detecting lead, and also an app and a Chrome extension that can also detect cyberbullying online. And what is even more impressive is that she is 15, and she was chosen out of 5,000 candidates in the US.
That's crazy. I haven't heard of this. I'm going to look this
up. I saw it on Instagram. Awesome. I was like, yeah!
I also saw that on Instagram. I was like, whoa, that is just so exciting.
Like, it makes me feel like, honestly, I'm looking at line, I'm just like, what was I doing at 15? Like, this girl is out here, like, inventing tech, like, changing STEM, changing the world, like, on her. Like, if they don't give her, I don't know, a Nobel Peace Prize somewhere down the line, like, I'm going to be shook. But I saw this, I'm just like, she is 15 doing
this. Yeah.
Like, good for her. Like, good for her. And I hope she continues, like, her excellent work. And, like, all the best to her and all of her ventures. And, like, big up for, like, women of color everywhere. So yeah. So those are just some of our selected highlights. So stay tuned for more after the break.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to Montreal by Mei Cheng featuring Drew Yowell, performed in 2018. So as mentioned at the jump of the show, we've got with us Serene, who is a member of the Pan-Asian, a founding member actually, as I just learned, of the Pan-Asian Collective, or PAC, based in Jojage, colonially known as Montreal. So hi, Serene.
Welcome.
Hello.
I had the sound effect, like the applause in the background.
Do you want to just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and what motivated you to found PAC?
For sure. I was at McGill for 2 years before joining the collective, and essentially what it was a bunch of women, Asian women of color, coming together to kind of create a space on campus where we felt like we could be inherently political. And it was really started by a few of my friends, Chris Lau, Yuan Kelly, and a few others. And they kind of told me about this idea that they were thinking about and had done like one movie night. And I had just come back from an exchange, and I was just so excited to be part of this because I felt like it was something that I was looking for so long. And it was like honestly one of the first places on campus that I really felt heard and that my identity and my lived experiences were really respected. So yeah,
that's, I can definitely relate to that. And when I saw this because I have a couple of friends who are members on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And when I saw this, I was really interested because this is one of like my all-time things that I kind of, I don't know, I don't want to call it a gripe because maybe that's too strong, but you know, I talk a lot about this with my friends about how, like, because I have a lot of friends that are Filipino or Pinay or Filipinx, and I always talk about how like it's just hard to have a sense of solidarity, or not hard to have a sense of solidarity, but it's hard for us to feel like a singular or like a unified or kind of integration with other Asian communities, particularly mm-hmm. in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when I saw this, I thought it was great because, you know, I think colloquially, and there are problems with this, but we will talk about like, you know, like the Black community or the Latino community. Mm-hmm. But the Asian community is kind of like, well, I'm not so sure, mm-hmm. you know? So
definitely.
I was really excited to see this. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about like what are some of the things that are on the kind of radar of the collective.
Sure. Before I get into that, I just want to speak on your point of like lack of Pan-Asian solidarity at some points. And I feel like that's a really important point to bring up just because, you know, I think that it can be so difficult just because there is such a diversity and multiplicity of experiences being racialized as Asian. Obviously, like, we come from such different backgrounds. Asia is such a huge place. It is understandable for me that, you know, people of like Asian heritage or who identify as Asian might not necessarily like see community with someone else that is Asian, just because, you know, East Asians and South Asians obviously too, like, historically have certain conflicts or just like don't identify with each other. And I think that's what Pan Asian Collective was about from the beginning for us, was that we're not going to pretend that we're the same. And in fact, we're going to do the opposite and emphasize our differences and be able to have conversations about certain privileges that, you know, folks in the Asian community have, and then privileges that some folks might not have. And it's that kind of acknowledgement and that space for discussion that actually really builds solidarity with us. So yeah, that's on that. And then some things that we've been working on are it just ended, but we had like a giveaway with businesses in Chinatown. A lot of folks that were part of the Pan Asian Collective were talking about how there was a lot of news about business, decrease in businesses, like in just like foot traffic in Chinatown, but also takeout and all these things related to anti-Asian, you know, racism and sentiments during the rise of COVID-19. And a lot of these businesses that have been in Chinatown for decades are kind of going out of business, and what can PAC do to kind of prevent that or try to build community solidarity with those different businesses. And we started a giveaway where you could, you know, post your food or whatever you got from Chinatown, and then in the end people could win all these different like small prizes that we kind of got. But we ended up raising over $3,000. People spent over $3,000 in Chinatown. Wow. And it really like took off. Like, people were really, really into it. So that was really exciting for us to see so much community support, like people outside of the McGill community, even just in the greater Montreal, just really paid attention to that Instagram post. So yeah. And then, I mean, even during the onset of COVID-19, like we made a statement on anti-Asian racism, and that got a lot of attention too. But in terms of other things, we're always doing like what we call unpack events. So we unpack a certain topic, and it's a discussion-based event that usually takes an hour to an hour and a half. And then so end of November, we did two. One was community care and activism burnout, and we did that with BSN in collaboration with the Black Student Network at McGill, and kind of had like this community discussion about how we can take care of each other and what activism burnout looks like. And then the other unpack event we did was just a couple days after that one, and it was on Uyghurs, Tibetans, and Hong Kongers and self-determination, independence, human rights movements in Asia, especially under the CCP.
That's really awesome. I think it's really, really cool that this space has emerged. I remember when I was a student at McGill, I was part of a network which I think was disbanded, which was like the RSN, the Racialized Student Network, which actually was also created out of the need for just that, like a space for other racialized folks to be able to talk about their experiences. So I think it's really cool that you're bringing these issues to the forefront, but also really bridging like issues among communities.
Absolutely. And what are things like now for businesses in Chinatown? Like, have things picked up, or have a lot of them closed down? Because I know there's a lot of like restaurants, grocery stores, like, and all that. Have they been able to kind of recuperate some of the foot traffic like post COVID, or has it not changed?
I from like the news that I've been reading, it stayed about the same. But I think, you know, it's important to keep in mind that what's really keeping these businesses going are those people that go back every week, that kind of keep that consistent flow into those small businesses. So it's just important to keep that in mind, you know, when we're doing our weekly grocery shopping or, you know, our takeout nights and things like that, to be supporting those businesses. Because really for them, like, it's right now, I feel like every dollar counts. And we just want to prevent as much as we can for those businesses, especially those who have been there for a long time, to not go out of business right now.
And since you're on the West Coast, like, what about in Vancouver? Has it been a similar thing, or has it been different?
It's definitely been a similar thing. To be honest, it's been really disheartening to go into Chinatown. Recently, you definitely do see like a major shift since COVID has started. There's just less people there, and it's the same thing for Chinatowns across Turtle Island, but like people are just afraid to go, especially people who are racialized as Asian, just because of all the like violence that took place during the beginning. And it's still kind of ongoing with all these different waves that are coming in, you know, first wave, second wave. Every single time there's like this new wave, there's just like another wave of anti-Asian racism. And so I think people are just afraid to go to Chinatown right now. People don't want to be hurt. So yeah, businesses are definitely shutting down. One of like the most like prized kind of bakeries, Chinese bakeries, in Chinatown closed down at the end of the summer, which was really heartbreaking for many of us that kind of grew up going to that spot. But it's kind of, I'm actually really impressed with Vancouver's Chinatown, that a lot of them are starting virtual stores. So there's other ways to support without having to go physically down there. So, I mean, people are trying to adjust, right? So that's all we can do at this point, is just to help with the adjustments and just be mindful of where we're spending our money.
Has the collective gotten any kind of support from, let's say, like the municipal governments, either in Vancouver or in Montreal, or like any kind of conversation regarding like a plan of action to help Chinatown or like Asian communities dealing with anti-racism? Has there been any kind of contact like on the government level?
I wouldn't say on the government level we've gotten any contact. I'd be shocked if someone on the government level took the time to contact us. We have been in contact with different organizations in Montreal. There's this organization called CRAW. Yeah. I forget the exact.
The Center for Research,
yes,
on
Racial.
Racial. Yeah.
Center I for can't research, remember the last cent, bit.
The research, the Center for Research for Action and Racial something. Yeah.
So CRAW, we signed on to the CRAW statement of anti-Asian racism and was kind of part of that conversation. But other than that, we definitely have not gotten any, we've not been in contact with anyone from local government. But I mean, we're open to it. They want to talk, we're here to talk.
But I mean, one of the things that I remember as being pretty significant in the beginning of the pandemic was that a lot of Asian communities were talking about like acts of violence, acts of blatant acts of, you know, racism, vandalism of businesses and stuff like that. And I think one of the things that was really shocking to me was the lack of news coverage that it got.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm wondering too, because I mean, you hear about it in passing. You mm-hmm. hear about it as being a concrete problem, kind of like, oh, this happened, on to the next news story. Mm-hmm. And then you have it being like framed as kind of like an American problem, while mm-hmm. this only happening in the US because of the rhetoric coming from their president. But then it happens here because we do have an Asian community here. And nothing in the news cycles. So that's why I was curious to see, like, maybe it's like, say, like on the municipal level, were there any like action plans that were put forward that you had heard of or gotten wind of? Because it's kind of the way that I'm seeing it, it's almost as if it's like a forgotten problem.
Definitely. I think that that's like a really accurate description of kind of what happened. I think that there was such an underreporting of attacks towards Asian folks during the onset of COVID. And that was kind of something that was argued even in Montreal, was looking at or asking police to record race during those attacks, because that was kind of something that the Montreal police were not doing.
They don't do that.
And then there was a lot of kind of like uproar about that, being like, why are we not taking into account the race of these individuals who are getting hurt? This is really important data for people to understand. So that was kind of like one thing that I kind of remember coming up a lot. But I mean, it's just like, I found that most of the information I was finding during these kind of attacks were just through like smaller news sources.
Right.
Like, you know, like the bigger ones that we all know.
It wasn't mainstream, it was more through like community?
Yeah, like community run like media pages, or just literally like people on Instagram posting about it. And so I feel like the community has really kind of fallen back and felt more support from like smaller like just like community run media, or just from people's personal Instagram pages, you know, different community care media places that are kind of trying to raise awareness about this. But I mean, like, this is just always a problem with media, like always underreporting racialized violence.
Yeah, but to me, I think it speaks to how the Asian community is also really invisibilized. I think in part because of what you had spoken about before, and how I would say some Asian communities avoid having those political discussions. Mm-hmm. But we cannot deny that the last few years, but particularly 2020, has been major for the issue of racial justice. You know, the killing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. I mean, you can go on and on and on. The that Black Lives Matter, for example, has taken not just in the United States, but globally, is undeniable. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think that conversation does need to be front and center. And I think, you know, obviously police brutality, you know, racialized violence against Black folks, like, definitely needs to be front and center again. But I also think, like, it's strange to me how that type of violence is not then taken into consideration, or that it's seen as being part of white supremacy when it's then enacted towards other groups. And so to me, I thought, like, it's just disappointing again to see how, like, the Asian community is not included in that discussion. Like, we talk a lot about violence against like Black and Brown folks, but like Asian people are brown too, you know what I mean? And it's not the same type of violence. Mm-hmm. There's not the same kind of social cultural background, there's not the same political context, but we're part of that spectrum too, and we're affected by racialized violence too, racial prejudice, discrimination too. And to me, it's like, we're somehow missing from that discussion, and I feel like we have something to contribute to that discussion. And not only because I think that first and foremost, we should be in solidarity with, you know, other folks of color, but also because we don't, you know, we're impacted too by, you know, the discriminatory practices, and the violence. And I think, as like kind of segue, we could talk about, you know, how the election of Kamala Harris actually touches on a lot of these points too. I know that you had sent like an article that was interesting. It was talking about Kamala Harris's her politics.
I mean, there's like I just agree with everything you said. And like, obviously, like, this denial of like violence towards Asians is really embedded in like the model minority myth, this idea that, you know, Asians are assimilated. We are technically like this like secondary white population in a lot of people's minds. And I think that, I mean, that comes also from the Asian community itself. Like the Asian community denies a lot of violence put onto them. Mm. So, you know, it's I think very much like a generational thing. Like people's parents who are first generation immigrants have a certain experience, and the way that they've been racialized affects the way that they speak out about issues of racism. But then, yeah, I think it's just an interesting time right now. Obviously, I think this summer with BLM protests has just been this moment of kind of like awakening for a lot of folks, just realizing things that a lot of folks like us have known this entire time. So that has been obviously, I think, both like enlightening and disheartening at the same time. Just, you know, people kind of coming around to see, or just to become radicalized by seeing these acts of violence. And I think it's exciting because it's nice for people to be asking these questions and be thinking about these things. But then it's disheartening to think that we have to undergo extreme, you know, visually stimulating violence in order for people to recognize something that racialized folks, especially Black and Indigenous folks, have been going through forever. And so, yeah, these moments are strange, but, you know, just trying to have conversations in ways that are productive, I guess, but also healing. So that's also just like, even this podcast, like having spaces for only women of color is so important, because right now I feel like the outside world is kind of just realizing our experiences, and it can be a lot sometimes to just be like, I don't want you to ask me actually right today. I'm really tired.
Well said. And I mean, you absolutely hit the nail on the head with that, because it's so true. And it brings us back to this conversation of like, was it as social media activism, all of that, and just the sharing of trauma constantly on these platforms, and the fact that it gets shared over like millions of times, millions and thousands of times, and that this isn't something new. And I think that you absolutely said it, where it's just like, it's exciting to know that it's happening now. And I think 2020 was kind of like that year of, I don't want to really say social awakening, but it has had its moments where it brought all of these like injustices towards racialized communities to the like forefront of the conversation. But it also goes back to what you're saying, Leah, that, you know, the Asian community is still missing from that. And I think it's amazing that PAC is having these like unpack sessions where you're also like including like other collectives to kind of form that solidarity that wasn't necessarily there before. And it, I think it's going to start a momentum where you see more and more of this happening, where these communities that were forgotten are now being included, and like we support each other. And that, even if it's not on, let's say, government level, because we all know like bureaucracy just sucks, and the reaction time from the government is not going to be one that's conducive to what like minority populations need in Canada. And if we can find that solidarity amongst ourselves, I think that is all that matters.
For sure. 100%.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that this year has been huge for issues of racial justice. And I would say that like, what it has been for me has been that like mainstream people in the mainstream, people who are part of the dominant culture, you know, white folks, but that also includes people of color who are in denial about experiences of racism too, because, you know, that article that you did share talked a lot about that as well, mm-hmm. Have just not been able to ignore anymore. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, well, people who have experienced this type of violence or who have, you know, been in communities that have been experiencing this violence, they don't need to see those videos because mm-hmm. they've experienced it. They know it. You don't need to see that. It's totally triggering. But what it's been like the people that have been more comfortable in spaces where they don't, you know, they've been sheltered from seeing those types of images, or just quite frankly, haven't wanted to believe that they exist, are now being confronted with the fact, it's like, no, you have to deal with this. And what I think has been so, you know, hopeful and powerful for me is really seeing the momentum of a lot of, you know, BLM and a lot of racial justice movements take such force and say like, no, we're not going, you know, we've been saying this for a really long time. We've been fighting for a really long time, and it's reached the degree to which like they can't be ignored anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's just been really, really positive among different communities, because each community is so diverse, you know, like no community is really monolithic. You can't say like the Latinx community or the Black community is monolithic either. There's all these, you know, diverse, you know, experiences within those communities. It's just, it would be great to kind of get behind this idea of like the ways in which white supremacy work and have a unique impact on each of us, but it's still uh-huh. the same thing. Even though it doesn't look the same for all uh-huh. of us, you know?
Uh-huh. Or like, it's like varying degrees of white supremacy manifesting differently in our lives. And I think recognizing that difference is like so incredibly important, because, you know, like, I think also even like there's more and more discussions about the way that we even talk about the differences in the way that people are oppressed. And I think that that's so important. Like there has been a lot of rise, and even talks about like white Latinx folks identifying as brown and how that makes people feel invisible. And even for like the Asian community, just discussions about how, you know, we're racialized differently. There's colorism in the Asian community. Let's talk about it. Let's stop like trying to deny this so that we can be together. Like being together is acknowledging that we have different privileges, and that like for me, like as a light-skinned Asian person, like it's my place to be putting my body in front of people, in front of my community that experiences things differently than I do. And I think like part of like that is just such a crucial part of that conversation, is to just not deny that, you know, we experience things differently, but, you know, kind of strategically come together to come to acknowledge these differences and to kind of think about solidarity work with the differences and privileges that we have.
Yeah, because it's like when people talk about equity and equality, it's like they have the same misconception when it comes to inclusion. Like inclusion doesn't mean everybody's the same. Mm-hmm. Inclusion means like what you're talking about, right? Which is acknowledging that actually none of us are the same, or we're, you know, and we, in order to be inclusive, you need to acknowledge those differences. So
like the oppressor wants to believe we are the same. The oppressor wants us to essentialize ourselves, and us saying like, no, we are different. That is radical. That is resistance. That's community care, like in its entirety, like just like being straight up, like saying no to those stereotypes and saying that we are different and we're allowed to be different. I think that's everything. And I mean, it's just connecting to this kind of point of Kamala Harris is like, I think right now with this kind of rise of radicalization and just people seeing racial violence for the first time in their lives, you know, there's this really strong tendency to want to see this as like the solution, and then kind of talking about, okay, how is that harmful? Like how is seeing this as a solution actually completely you know, washing or like just denying like the amount of oppression, both like in terms of like for women, but like these intersections of oppression that are like complicit in like this like you know, in the system that we live in, like, you know, this idea of like a woman of color coming in as vice president can kind of seem like a moment of rest for people or a moment of celebration. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a certain degree to which, you know, we can see this as a win. We can see this as like, okay, let's celebrate this representation, but then questioning, what does this representation really mean? What is this really going to do for us?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm curious as to what you folks think about this kind of notion of like, Black women will save us. It's so problematic.
It is, and I feel like it's kind of like what the article mentions, kind of like this go-to, even like with the election, it was kind of just like, you know, don't worry, like even like we already know like which way like white men are going to vote, and the fact like, you know, large majority of them voted for Trump, and then you had like the wave of Black women coming in and voting like primarily for like Biden, then it's like, look, like Black women again, once again, it's just like they have to put everything aside to go and like save everybody and like right the wrongs of like, you know, white supremacy. And I think that again was like the hope with Kamala, but the thing with Kamala Harris is that she also comes with her own baggage, so to speak, in terms of like the laws that she has like reinforced or protective or her viewpoints. And I feel like, yes, it's kind of like what you mentioned, there is that moment of quote unquote rest, but it's still like you still have to hold her accountable. And the fact of her being like a woman of color does not kind of erase like what she has done and what she has been complicit in terms of like oppressive laws and like systems. And I think moving forward, it is something that definitely needs to get undone, and this mentality that needs to get undone, because at the end of the day, it's just like, it's not for like Black women to like hold all of society on their shoulders to like correct the wrongs of like all the past wrongs that have happened to like people of color, minorities, and like women of color in general. But I am curious to see like over the next 4 years, how she will like assume a lot of that like account and be accountable to what she has done and try to change the system from within now that she is in a very, very high position of power. So that's, I'm just wondering why we need to continue. Like, I mean, it is positive, and like, yes, we can praise her all we want, but I'm just hoping that after this kind of like honeymoon period is over and like we're able to take off the rose colored glasses, that we will see it for like what it is, and that she's still, regardless, she is still part of the system she helped create.
I mean, it was the same too with like Obama. I feel like the most problematic thing with Obama was kind of just this tendency of white folks to be like, I voted for Obama, and then that's like
the end.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, you voted for Obama, and then what? Now you're not a racist? Now you're like totally like off the hook?
Absolution of all, racist thoughts. It's like, no, I can't be racist because I voted for a Black president.
Yeah,
it's like kind of exactly the same thing. Not only am I not racist, I'm not sexist either. So I can't say anything misogynistic. I can't be saying anything racist.
Yeah.
Because look, guys, you got your woman. You got your first female vice president. And on top of that, like, she's also like, Asian, and she's Black. Look at that. You are checking off all the boxes.
Yeah.
Like, you can't complain anymore. Like, let's stop all of this.
That's
you
know? Literally what it is. And I feel like that's like the tendency that makes it actually more silencing sometimes. Like, for some reason, now that, you know, Kamala Harris is vice president, like, are we still allowed to be angry about things? Like, are we just going to be shut down anytime we say anything? Like, that's kind of what I'm a little bit worried about. Like, I'm just like really aware of that. But also just like with, I'm just thinking back to like Obama presidency is thinking about like, okay, like, you know, we still have to be acknowledging that these people are criminals. Like Obama's a war criminal. I like where I'm just saying this, it's just a fact, but you know, a lot of people kind of reminisce this Obama period as like this, like, oh my gosh, like I just miss Obama. And it's like, okay, but like it doesn't matter if Obama or another Black president, or we have another Black president, like we still have these issues, you know, they're not going to be fixed just because a racialized person is in power. Mm-hmm. That just makes you think it's fixed. But we all that live this experience know that it's very much not fixed. And like all the pink washing that happens, you know, and all the other things that kind of are glorified, you know, kind of avoid the real conversations and the real change from happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like a major concern of a lot of people of color with this election is kind of like, okay, well, are the people that have been doing the work before, or like nonprofit organizations, or, you know, whatever it is that was doing the work during the Trump administration, is that kind of going to be over now because of the new, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly hope so. And I don't think that many people would, you know, agree. I think a lot of people would think that, no, more than ever, we need to push things more to the left and be much more progressive than what the Biden-Harris platform is offering us. You know, like, I don't think that anybody who's really committed to the idea of social justice, truly committed to the idea of social justice, would say, oh, well, the buck stops here. Like, you know, what I liked about that article was that it did talk about, like, when you distill somebody down just to their racial identity and think that representation alone is enough, like, that's just fake, you know? And that's part of seeing people of color as real people, as like full humans, and not just as their racial identity, and people who have political ideology, you know, people who have political agendas, you know, people who have, you know, belief systems. And I don't think anybody, when it comes to Harris or when it comes to Obama, can deny, like, there are two sides to, or multiple sides to that person. Would I prefer to see, you know, Kamala Harris or Obama in the White House as opposed to like another old fat white dude? Hell yeah. Like, hands down. Like, there's no question in my mind
for sure.
You know, that I want those people to be occupying those spaces. But does that mean I give them like a carte blanche or like a 100% pass? Like, no. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that anybody who's actually like understands these issues should get that.
Yeah. You know? And I think that's one of the things that has happened online. It's kind of like, yeah, we have this result from the election, but the work continues. I think for those, like you said, like for those who are really involved in social justice, they will continue pushing that and not be afraid to hold this new administration accountable. But then it goes back to what you were saying, Shireen, is that at the end of the day, this is something that will come up. I mean, the hope is that it doesn't, but it will always be the go-to to be like, stop talking about it. We've dealt with it. 2020 was the year. It was your year for racial justice. It was your year to, you know, to like defund the police and all that. We're good. It's always going to come back no matter what. It's always mm-hmm. going to be a thing. The moment that race is brought up in any sphere, mm-hmm. in any environment, it's, let's not talk about it. It's in the past. Yeah.
Or just like white folks just being like, also like, 2020 was like really intense. Like, I like did a lot of learning. I'm like,
exactly.
I'm kind of done. Like,
I googled
kind of tired.
I googled it. I'm good. I learned. I'm not a racist. I was an ally, and just like,
oh my god,
like, you're sharing the black square for your allyship, but there's more to it, you know?
Exactly. And I think that, like, I don't know. I feel like this moment is just really telling of, like, I mean, even like the radicalization in racialized communities, like this summer, like I feel also that just like with this election, like people like for sure me too, just like being really cognizant of the fact that people of color can do harm too, mm-hmm. is just like, I feel like it's really mind blowing for a lot of people. This idea that people of color can harm other people of color is just like, especially for white folks, is just like, there's no way that could ever happen. And if we elect one of these people, like, that's just kind of like this like magic fairy stick that's just gonna fix everything. And it's like, that is a legacy of colonization and the way that capitalism has deteriorated marginalized communities. Like, it's not gonna be fixed by one person being in office. And that's even just like, just this idea of like people of color can harm other people of color is just like, even in community care, like going back to PAC, like, or just even our solidarity work with other folks is just so like, it's such a thing that I have to constantly remind myself to being like, I am a woman of color and I am very capable of doing harm onto other folks. And like, what does that mean for me? How does that change the way that I'm talking? How does that change the way that I kind of like even see my privilege within these spaces? I think that's just like, everyone's just kind of like coming to terms with this. Like a lot of folks are coming to terms with this, with the new like radicalization that kind of took place this summer. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's just like, it's very counterintuitive for a lot of people to kind of think this way. But I'm glad that it's encouraging this type of conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So with that, we'll take the musical break and be back with more Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Doing it right, fighting the fights, making it right, taking the flights, catching the heights, standing in the lights, center stage, turn the page.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to the beautiful song All My Relations by Ulali. Am I saying that right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So as usual, we're finishing off our discussion with our self-care segment. This month is a little different as we finally are coming to an end of 2020, which has been a very surreal year. With that, I'm wondering if Mercedes and Serene want to review the year a little bit. I'm wondering how you feel, if I can ask that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely been surreal. Like I feel like there's so much that has happened to keep track of. And I'm just glad I made it to December. There's been a lot of loss that, you know, it has happened. So there's not a lot of people that can say the same. And I guess I'm just grateful that I was able to have, you know, the support I needed from friends and family, and that, you know, everyone's good health. I know that's kind of like a selfish overview of the year, but hey, it's my overview. So it is what it is. But I can say it is one that I will definitely not forget, especially in terms of like how it made me feel and like the different emotions, frustration, anger, unknown, not even categorized, because I feel personally like I don't have words for 2020. Mm. Like I don't know what to say 2020 was. It wasn't good. It wasn't bad. It was definitely terrifying. Mm-hmm. But it's just kind of something like, I feel like 2020 for me was just like an out of body experience. Like I wasn't mm-hmm. actually living it. I was kind of like looking at it through like somebody else's mm-hmm. like perspective. But I'm just hoping that moving on to 2020, not moving on to 2020, 2021, like I'm stuck in a 2020 vortex, like moving on to 2021, that it'll be kind of a rebirth where like everything went up in flames this year and like out of the ashes, you know, like a phoenix is born kind of thing. And the lessons that, you know, have come out of 2020 can be taken forward by everyone in order to kind of forge the year that we want to have and the future that we want to see. So that's me.
I love that reflection.
Thank you.
Now, do you want to go?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. I feel like I really relate to what Mercedes said. It's just been a really weird year, especially just as someone who very much identifies as an extrovert. Like, just like completely actually like being alone was just so weird for me. Just as someone that's always with friends or family, just like during the beginning part when I was still in Montreal, like finishing school, not seeing anyone. I think it was important though, because it, you know, made me have reflections that I wouldn't have had, but I relate. It was so terrifying. So I don't even know what to say about it. I'm like, can I say it's good? Like, it wasn't great, but I'm okay. So like, I can't say it was that bad, because it's just like so many people, like even in my life, who I've heard just, it's affected them so differently. And I just feel so grateful. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel very much the same. I'm like, I don't even know if there are words to describe this time.
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah, I have to say I'm with both of you on that. It's, you can't just summarize what just happened and what is still happening, you know. Mm-hmm. I think for me though, what I would take away from this year was just like how exposed the ways of which we are all connected was really like that to me. I think, I hope that a lot of people got that. Not only like just as a species, but how like, and how we can be impacted by the environment around us, by, you know, by illness, by animals, by weather, by like movement, by all of these things, but also like, you know, how we are able to live because of the contributions and the work of other people, and how all, you know, we're all much more intricately and directly connected to other people than we really realize. And I really hope that moving forward, that's gonna be something that stays with all of us. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in my job, I've seen how basically like our society, and I I've known this for a long time, but it was really exposed during the pandemic. It's like how our society is basically built on the backs of migrants, and particularly migrant women and racialized migrant women. And it's always been the case, right? You know, and I would include that also to be women of color in general, people of color in general, and include like Indigenous folks in that as well. But, you know, in my life, it's, that has just been so apparent. And I just really think that moving forward, and my hope is for 2021, is that like, that's taken to be part of whatever going back to normal, you know, air quotes, around normal looks like, because it's just, you just can't, it's unethical to, to ignore that the way that our society, treats people, particularly, you know, migrants and racialized communities, but also how, you know, we can't, like the way in which we're living is actually really unsustainable, and how we were just like flattened by this, by COVID, you know? And it's like, well, why do we spend 8 hours a day, or if not more, at work? Why do we do that? Because you can't take care of yourself or the people around you, or your kids or elderly folks in your life when you do that. Like, why are these things happening? And who is actually doing that work? So I don't know, I'm not super hopeful that that will be something that will continue on, but I do hope that it's something that at least sticks around for a little while.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like what you said is so true. Like, I feel like this summer, just with COVID too, was such like a moment of like realizing anti-capitalism for a lot of people too. Just like being like, this actually doesn't make any sense. Why are we doing this? You know, why are essential workers being paid so little? Just all these questions that just come from like this moment where things aren't normal.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And not only that, it's just the cracks that need to be like genuinely repaired, not just plastered over with like a quick fix, but the general like dismantling of certain procedures and like systems that have been going on behind the scenes that we were not necessarily made aware of until this pandemic happened.
I'm cognizant of the time though. So yeah, we just want to give a shout out to our listeners and say, you know, we'd love to hear from you. And on our Facebook page. And we want to hear all voices, Black, Indigenous, women, and femmes of color. This is a platform for you. So please reach out to us if you want to hear, if you want a spot on the show, if you want to talk about your podcast.
Welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African current affairs and analysis brought to you by, well, today by Heldon, Doug, and myself, Gwen, each from the safety of our separate homes. Heldon, what are you going to be doing tonight?
Yes, hi, Gwen. It's always lovely to see you guys. And I really can't wait to get back to the studio, just for some reasons to see you guys. Yeah. So, but last week I started by doing small reviews of different news that is coming from the continent, and I'll be doing three brief ones again for this week. So stay tuned to Amandla.
Fabulous. And Doug, what about you?
Well, I've got a little short on Pata Pata. A new version has come.